Welcome to the statewide conversation with Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. It's an opportunity to ask questions about Minnesota's response and plans during this COVID-19 pandemic. Collaboration of community radio stations throughout the state in partnership with AMPRS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota Communities, and the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. If you didn't get a chance to send or call in your question this week, you can email covid@ampers.org or call 612-562-9895. I'm Heidi Holton. I'm live from KAXE Studios on the Mississippi River in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Thank you for listening today. And we have joining us now Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Heidi.
You are welcome. So let's get right into the questions we got this week. A number of our listeners have questions about testing of COVID-19. This listener wrote that they saw on Facebook that you got tested this week. They want to know how it went. Was it different than you expected? Some people are very anxious about getting this test. What did you observe and experience?
Yeah, sure. So I'm happy to answer that question. You know, I want to emphasize that different people have different experiences with getting the test. There's a few different types of swabs that might affect how the test goes for you. I have actually had two different tests. And the first one that was done was with a longer swab that went further into my nasal cavity. It was uncomfortable, but it didn't hurt, and it was over pretty quickly. And the most recent test that I had was a shorter swab and just went into sort of like the top of my nose, and they literally just swirl it around in there for a few seconds. It tickles and it feels like you really have to sneeze. But those moments of discomfort were totally worth it when I got my results back that said that I was negative. So I just encourage people, don't be afraid. It is unpleasant, but it doesn't hurt. And that was my experience. And we just want folks to get tested.
Did you go into a clinic? Did you do it in your car?
So at one instance, I was in the clinic, and in the other, the most recent time that I was tested, I was in the State Emergency Operations Center and was tested by members of the National Guard.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into some more questions about testing, especially a lot of people are worried about the large groups of people that have been together protesting the murder of George Floyd. We heard from Tom in Grand Rapids, and he said he's been really worried about this opening up of things as things change. He still isn't comfortable going into public because in where he is, he doesn't see a lot of masks in the hardware store and places like that. So he is... Then as he watched the protests on TV, he had these, you know, differing feelings. Normally he would have probably been there, is what he said, but didn't feel comfortable doing that. So he's worried about the people that were there, and he's wondering how the state is supporting peaceful protests, but also still asking people to be safe. How are you handling that?
For sure. Well, Tom, I really appreciate this question. And you know, we are experiencing a real change in our state, and it's a very powerful moment. And for many of us, our instinct is to run to each other in those moments. But I also know the fear and the guilt that can be associated right with that as well. You know, the COVID-19 pandemic has really complicated this response. But as we've seen people who have been protesting, many of them are wearing masks, are carrying hand sanitizer, and are doing things as safely as possible. One of the things that helps is that people are outdoors, and I think that makes a difference. But I think that, you know, you're right to be cautious and concerned, Tom. In order to make this slow reopening work, we need folks to continue wearing masks, washing their hands, practicing good social distancing or physical distancing, which might make more sense to talk about it that way. And many of those behaviors were present, as I mentioned earlier, right, in the protests themselves in Minneapolis. But we still don't know the impacts of that those protestings had on the spread of COVID-19 right now, which is why we're working to expand testing across the state, but especially in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and offering pop-up testing locations as well to ensure that those who were protesting can get tested. But I also wanted to speak to this. It is, as someone who has been an advocate and an organizer for a very long time, and now is in the role of lieutenant governor, it is hard for me to not run to the streets and to protest alongside members of the community. One of the things that I was able to do and have been there twice is go to the location at 38th in Chicago, the really sacred space now where community gathers, where George Floyd was murdered. One of the things something I was able to do was to drop off about 200 masks for folks there, as well as some hand sanitizer from our partners in distilleries who have changed what they're making for a little bit to support the community. So I was able to do that and then just visit with people, listen to music, and just be in community, which is clearly where so many of us are drawn right now. But there are lots of ways to get engaged and involved. You can contribute financially if you're able to the rebuilding efforts on the south side of Minneapolis, north side of Minneapolis, or St. Paul. You can talk to your elected officials, frankly, about the police reform and accountability pieces of legislation that are being introduced by the People of Color and Indigenous Caucus, which are really critical at this time. And then I would also say, you can talk to your friends and neighbors. This moment that we find ourselves in to make real systemic change has been a long time in the making. And so sometimes Minnesota nice or being polite gets in our way of being able to have these really critical and courageous conversations about racism in the state of Minnesota. So Tom, if you're willing to talk to your friends and neighbors, I think that goes a really long way too.
You're listening to a statewide conversation with Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. Thanks for tuning in today. Along those lines, this is an interesting question we got from the St. Cloud area. We are coming up on 3 months of living with COVID-19 with a stay-at-home order for the bulk of that time. How do you think this situation did or did not contribute to the anger, the unrest, the violence we saw in response to the killing of George Floyd?
Well, I would say, we certainly know that Minnesota has deep inequities in health and education, public safety, housing, criminal justice, nearly in every aspect of life. And Black and Brown and Indigenous Minnesotans have fewer options and worse outcomes than white Minnesotans. That's just a fact. And the anger and the grief and, like, just fundamental unfairness and injustice have been simmering under the surface in our state for generations. So couple that with COVID, and that we see that COVID-19 has fallen really hardest on the Black community and on communities of color overall. The same inequities that really led to the murder of George Floyd, are the ones that have been responsible for the impact of COVID-19 and the disproportionate impact on people of color. They're very much connected. And so I think that is why this moment feels so different. People of color in Minnesota, myself included, have been asking for years, when will things change? When will it be enough? And, I had a conversation earlier this week with Valerie Castile, the mother of Philando Castile. And, she said, Peggy, she said, God gave you Philando and it wasn't enough. And then God gave you George Floyd. This is an opportunity and it has to be enough. And so that is the fire in my belly. That is what is fueling this moment. And like, as a mom talking to another mom, enough is enough. And I think that is palpable in Minnesota in this moment. And so I think people are seeing the disproportionate impacts of COVID-19. The world had stopped in many ways where people were seeing it on their cell phones and on their computer screens, watching the live murder of one of our community members. and it was simply too much. And now is the moment where we need to push for big systemic change, and it's time.
You know, you mentioned in as you were addressing the question that came in from Tom about that, suggesting there are other things to do, even if you're not on the streets and helping out. And one of those, you said, contact your elected officials. You know, it's we're besides dealing with the murder of George Floyd and COVID-19, we are in an election year and things are just very complex and complicated. You've been a legislator before, you're lieutenant governor now. Do you actually pay attention to those calls or emails or letters that come into you?
100%. And so I can tell you as a legislator, one of the tools that, you know, is most powerful for legislators is, you know, getting a personalized email, a personalized postcard or note, talking about what is at stake for you personally and for your community. That always makes a big difference. Form emails and petitions, if they're coming in from people who live in your district, can make a difference. But it really is that personalization that is key. We are in a really unique moment in Minnesota, also just in that the legislature is back in session today. It is a special session. The governor called the special session on Wednesday because the legislature, every 30 days when we are in a state of emergency, needs to vote on whether or not to extend the governor's emergency power. So they are back here because of that. However, because of this moment that we find ourselves in, we also have an incredible opportunity to make some real change with regards to public policy. So I just want to encourage people that they need to reach out to their elected officials if they have concerns. I think many of us do, around police reform and accountability, things such as banning chokeholds, things like the use of force and the sanctity of life, post-board reform, which determines the licensure of police officers in the state of Minnesota. Those are all things that we actually just had a press conference yesterday. The governor, myself, the Speaker Hortman, as well as minority leader Susan Kent, and then the People of Color and Indigenous Caucus in the Minnesota State Legislature. I was one of the founding members of that caucus, and, you know, even then, we had a whole host of criminal justice reforms and police accountability policies that were developed and ready to go. Those policies, that agenda of the People of Color and Indigenous Caucus, is the agenda of the governor's office as well. We stood in solidarity with them yesterday, and these are things that are not new ideas, that do not, frankly, take a tremendous amount of time to learn more about. We simply need leaders, the Senate GOP in particular, to hear the voices of people of color who are saying, these are the things that we need to feel safe. And then that's the first step. We then look to the summer and to fall and elections, and then to the next legislative session, which is a budget year, about how we are going to invest and reinvest in communities who've been affected by COVID-19, but also by the trauma of what occurred in Minneapolis. So now's the time. Let folks know. Call them, email them, send them notes, reach out on social media. And if you come to the Capitol, you are absolutely welcome. But please remain socially distanced and bring some friends and some signs.
You know, I wonder if you would help us understand a little bit. You talked about the special session that starts today, and I have been seeing news reports that Republicans especially have been unhappy with the peacetime emergency that has allowed Governor Walz to make quicker and swifter decisions related to COVID-19. Why is that peacetime emergency necessary still, and where would we be if we hadn't had that in place?
So that's a great question. I would say, you know, we are still in a state of emergency. We had 25 deaths from COVID-19 today. And although in many areas in Minnesota today, the sun is shining and it is beautiful outside, we still are in a time of pandemic. They're decisions that we need to make quickly and efficiently. One example is just being able to deliver health care and mental health care in particular to people and make sure that those providers are still paid and reimbursed. That was a decision that was needed to be made by executive order under this state of emergency, these emergency powers. And there's a whole list. Evictions, for example, there's a moratorium on evictions. As soon as that state of emergency ends, people could potentially be kicked out of their housing. And so we need this time with the legislature also to ensure that we're passing $100 million in housing assistance to make sure that that doesn't happen. So, you know, I'll just be like really candid with you though and say, Heidi, you know, we are in this time and this state of emergency. And we simultaneously hear Senate Republicans saying we want the governor's emergency powers to end so that we can share the work in governing through this healthcare crisis. But literally at the same press conference said we're only going to show up for 1 week of work and we'll end next Friday. Like, you can't have it both ways. And so, you know, we are in the work. We are ready to partner with our friends in the legislature. We are in constant communication with them, but we are still in a state of emergency. And until they adopt some of the things, frankly, that we've moved during this time through executive order, the $100 million in particular for people who are having a difficult time paying their rent or mortgage, we think that it needs to remain in place.
It's going to be interesting to watch this special session. And I think people right now, the time we're in, they're paying attention more to the news. Mm-hmm. And my hope is they get involved more and they do reach out to their elected officials or even think for themselves that they might want to run for office someday. It's
absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to another question we got from one of our listeners on Facebook. This has to do with testing and antibodies. The current testing that is open to everyone tells you whether you are currently positive or negative for the virus that causes COVID-19, but that doesn't tell you whether you might have been positive at one time. That would require an antibody test. When will we have more widespread access to antibody tests?
So that's a really important question right now, and serology tests are a valuable component in our strategy to battle COVID-19, not only to see if Minnesotans have previously had COVID, but also to be able to come up with new treatment strategies, like convalescent serum injections from people who have immunity to those who are currently sick or infected with COVID-19. It's really revolutionary work, and I think it's one of the places where, as Minnesotans, we can feel good about that in this moment because that work is happening at the Mayo Clinic and at the University of Minnesota to determine how effective those treatments might be. But I also want to be really clear that this isn't, you know, sort of a silver bullet. The jury is really still out on serology testing, and if they can accurately and reliably test for these COVID-19 antibodies. The problem is that many of the tests that are being used and marketed cannot detect the exact COVID-19 virus. And nearly all of us have had some kind of coronavirus in our lives, like the common cold. So our Department of Health is hard at work right now tracking these serology tests, and we've begun to incorporate some of these results into our tracking data. And this data will become much more powerful as we continue to develop more sensitive tests. So, you know, just to that point, that it remains critically important that we keep that 6 feet of distance between us and people we don't live with, wash our hands frequently, and wear masks where physical distancing is impossible.
We had another question that came in about the virus itself. Dell and Celine wrote to us. They wanted to know about super spreaders and how they are identified.
Sure. So this is a new term, I think, for us as we are looking at this pandemic. And you know, even though it feels like we've been living with COVID-19 for a long time, it really isn't very old, and there's still a lot that we don't know about the virus, and we're learning more every day. So some folks are using the term super spreader to explain situations in which one person infects many more people than we would generally expect. So public health experts really rely on contact tracing or looking for how and where people contract COVID-19. And then they look at the places and people that someone with COVID-19 came into contact with during the time that they were very contagious. Contact tracing is an incredibly important tool. It helps us to stop further spread of the virus. And we're currently building out our contact tracing strategy across the state right now, bringing more and more people on the team, and also more and more people who are grounded in specific cultural communities and who can speak languages other than English, to make sure that we've got credible messengers and people who folks across different communities can trust when they're having these conversations about COVID-19 and where they've been and who they've been with, so that we can try to stop the spread. But it takes a lot of people and a lot of conversations. And these contact tracers are some of the really unsung heroes, I think, in the front lines of COVID-19, who are calling people, leaving messages, calling them again, trying to get folks on the phone, and then having really intentional conversations that take, you know, a pretty good chunk of time about each individual's experience so that we can use that data and try to stop the spread.
That just reminded me that we had heard, I think, from the Attorney General's office to watch out for some scams. Some people are getting text messages about that say that someone you know has coronavirus, and to know that it's going to be a person that is calling you.
That is exactly correct, yeah. Heidi. You will get a phone call from a real live person. It is just tragic and unfortunate that there are some people who would take advantage of folks during a time of crisis and pandemic. But I think that's just generally when folks reach out to text message, if they ask you for your personal health information or data, social security number, that kind of thing, that's always should be a red flag. To not provide that information digitally until you have verification of where that's going. But our contact tracers will absolutely call you. They will not text.
Okay. We heard from Jenny from Bemidji. She just wrote in and she was asking about college campuses. She said as they make plans for the coming academic year, leadership is taking into consideration the mission of their respective schools and safety of students, economics, politics. Some have said that there's no way to safely have students back on the ground. And some have said that there will be welcoming students back to campuses. What are your thoughts?
So, you know, we are working in close partnership with our higher education institutions across the state. There's some campuses, frankly, like Mitchell Hamlin, which has done a lot of distance learning as part of their law school model, and will be able to continue that in some way into the fall. There's other places where, with the University of Minnesota, where the president there has indicated that they'll be welcoming students back if they can, and maybe wrapping up the semester, or at least the in-person classes, by Thanksgiving. We are still determining ourselves, in partnership with the Department of Education, what we will be advising folks to do in the fall for our students. It is an incredibly difficult decision to make. But our hope is that that each campus is taking into consideration first and foremost the overall health and well-being of their students, and providing the tools for folks to be able to do this as safely as possible. So for access to the ability to deep clean and sanitize, access to masks. Really thinking about those class sizes and how closely people will be, sitting together and for what duration of time. All of those things are what need to be taken into account. And, you know, Heidi, we've talked about this before. My daughter's a long way from being in college, but, you know, she's going into second grade in the fall. And, I think about You know, there's the summer slide for kids, and now that we're talking about the COVID slide, I think the governor and I are deeply committed to trying to figure out a way where we can send our students back in a way that is safely, that allows them to keep up academically at this time as well. So we'll have additional updates both from, you know, our Department of Education for our pre-K-12 kiddos, as well as from the Office of Higher Education regarding, you know, what additional guidance we can give for campuses to be able to determine how to safely welcome students back.
Before we go, we have a question for you about your job, a personal question, about how you and the governor are keeping in touch about all that's going on. Do you get to weigh in on his decisions? Do you always agree with him? What happens if you don't? And they also asked if you... They said, can you believe all the things your administration has had to deal with? It is hard to constantly get criticized and second-guessed by everyone in the media and on social media. How do you handle all of this?
Did my mom send this question into you?
It's anonymous. I can't say.
Is it hard, to get criticized and second-guessed by people on social media? Yeah, it's unpleasant. I don't like it. And it's part of the job. And I'm really honored to be able to do that job. So you get through it. Can I believe all of the things that our administration has been faced with in these first 18 months? I mean, even just like the last few months and weeks? No. But I feel like, this is one of the reasons why the governor and I decided to run together. I think if you see us together in public, which has been, you know, certainly less so over the last several months, you can tell that we're buddies and we're friends and we really respect each other. But we have different lived experiences, and that's one of the reasons why we decided to form a team. And I think now is that time. I've been working on issues of racial equity for a long time in my role as an organizer, as a child advocate in the legislature, and certainly now as lieutenant governor. And even yesterday, as we stood with the People of Color Indigenous Caucus, the governor was very clear that his role is to create the space to ensure that the voices of communities of color are heard, and that his job is to support this legislation and to try to get it through. And that's one of the reasons, frankly, why I'm on this ticket and why I'm part of this team. We don't always agree, but not everybody always agrees, but we have respectful dialogues and we move forward together. While usually we sit in our conference room and we're both side to side at the head of the table, we can't do that anymore. And so we see each other over Zoom meetings and Microsoft Teams and are constantly in contact also by phone. And we have decided to spend some time together at these press events, which have been really pivotal moments right now as we are responding to this crisis, as we watch the murder of George Floyd. And although, you know, we have a continuity of operations plan and have tried to social distance as much as possible, that moment also took us, you know, to try to take that risk and be at a press conference in a way that is socially distanced, because it was really important that we appear together when we're talking about these issues. So it's hard, but I know what I signed up for, and I have to tell you that, like, it is an honor to serve people in Minnesota and try to grapple and push through these issues together right now, and that I'm grateful to be able to do it with one of my best buddies.
You know, I've seen footage of Governor Walz with your daughter. I bet he misses seeing her.
Yes, and certainly over Zoom calls, she has lots to say to the governor, or to Timmy, as she likes to call him.
That's Minnesota's Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. Thank you so much for your time again today.
Thanks so much, Heidi. Take good care and have a good weekend.
You too. This broadcast is a collaboration of community radio stations throughout the state in partnership with Ampers, Diverse Radio for Minnesota Communities, and the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. You can listen to this full conversation at kaxc.org or ampers.org. And if you would like to ask a question about COVID-19, email us COVID@ampers.org or call 612-562-9800. 9-5. I'm Heidi Holton for KEXE, KBXE. Thanks for listening.